Joining me now on Fresh Air is John Ritchie, who's known for his novels about gay men. Ritchie writes about what many people consider to be the most lurid aspect of the gay underground, the sex hunt, the constant search for men to have sex with, in toilets and S&M bars and parks, wherever it can be had. This is a gay lifestyle that many gay men have disavowed as being decadent and superficial. Ritchie's first novel, City of Night, which was published in 1963, was for many readers their introduction to the gay men's underground. His book, The Sexual Outlaw, a documentary, which is a mix of nonfiction and fiction, was an attempt to make political sense of the gay male sex hunt. His newest book is called Rushes, and this is set in a leather and western bar. It's published by the Grove Press. Ritchie is in Philadelphia for an autograph party tomorrow at Giovanni's Room that's located on 12th and Pine Streets. The autograph party will be held from 3:30 till 5:30 in the afternoon. Then in the evening, he'll be doing a reading at the Gay Coffee House, located at 326 Cater Street. That's near 4th and South Streets. And the reading will be between 7:30 and 9:30 in the evening. And if you missed that, I'll be giving all that information again a little later. John Ritchie, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. It's good to be here.
What do you think? What effects do you think your books have had on gay men who have read them? Gay men who have come out of the closet and who have not come out of the closet?
Okay. Remember that my first book, City of Night, came out in 1963, and that was a time of great closetry. For many people, many people, this was the first book that they read that was overtly homosexual in theme. And it really was, I'm proud to say, a galvanizing book. I mean, it's a book that created a lot of shockwaves, but it had a great impact then. One of the things that I cherish the most when I'm doing any autographing or any kind of publicity, the number of people that come up and say, you know, you really helped me to come out. And I, you know, I feel very honored. I feel very honored to have had that kind of influence. On the other hand, as things change and new generations come up, people then look at City of Night and forget that it was in 1963. And then a younger generation says, but this is a very repressed book about a hustler who gets paid for sex. So there's that dual thing. And since it's taught in colleges and universities now in literature courses, that's a question that I constantly get. So there's two realities. The people for whom it was a book that really brought them up, and the people who now actually see it as a very as a book dealing with repression.
Do many gay men tell you that they feel that you misrepresent gay men because you write about things like sadomasochism and leather bars and hustlers?
Yeah, I get that, Terry. But you see, I think we're in a very crucial time. I mean, we're in the 80s, and I think that one of the devastating things that is happening is, and I understand the reasons for it. I mean, you could catalog all the reasons. I always say emphatically that whenever I criticize anything in the homosexual world, and I don't use the word gay, and it slips by now and then, I always make a preface that if I criticize the homosexual world, there is an implicit, harsher criticism of the heterosexual world. I am very critical of many things that are happening in the homosexual world. But I always underscore that the criticism is much harsher on the heterosexual world because they have created us by their pressures. We're the only minority that is literally born into the enemy camp. Blacks are born into supportive black families, Chicanos into Chicano families. The homosexual is born in secret. And you know, when they talk about homosexuals molesting children, I think there's hardly a homosexual child that has not been molested by a heterosexual teacher imposing on him or her a modality of life that that is just not our own. That is just absolutely not our own. So I think that there's a great deal of dishonesty going on now. When I criticize it, you know, I underscore what I just said. And part of the dishonesty is we're being lacerated so much by, you know, the Anita Bryants and the other crazies and, you know, those of us who don't live in big cities. I mean, I live in Los Angeles, so I do, but in small cities, we tend to think that the war is over and that we're winning, when in point of fact, it isn't true. We're losing on many fronts, I think. And one of the worst is confusing heterosexual imitation, absorption into a so-called heterosexual norm, and calling that liberation. What I champion is the right to be different. And I think we homosexuals should remain different and not feel that liberation is adhering to those strict codes that heterosexuals have established.
I think one of the differences you're referring to is promiscuity.
Absolutely.
And I'd like to quote a couple of things from two of your books.
All right.
You write, "The promiscuous homosexual is a sexual revolutionary." Then you later write, "Public sex is revolution. Courageous, righteous, defiant revolution." What is revolutionary about promiscuity?
Okay. You have to begin with the understanding, I mean, to follow my theory, one has to begin with the understanding that homosexuals are persecuted and prosecuted for their sexuality. Not because we are black, not because we are poor, not because we are ethnic, okay? It is our sexuality. No matter how we try to get away without, and this is one of the things that I decry, the de-emphasis on the sexual. I find a new, raging, ugly puritanism on the homosexual front, okay? We are persecuted because of our sexuality. Otherwise, we could pass so easily. So you have to accept that basis. Okay, then how is public sex, then, revolutionary? Now, as I view it, for example, the black woman who really started the civil rights movement in the South sat on a bus after she'd been working very hard and her feet hurt, and she did not walk to the back of the bus, and they tried to get her to walk to the black-only section, and she said no. That was a revolutionary act because she confronted the law where it was visible. She could have easily gone home and said, "Those so-and-sos, you know, they made me sit at the back." But at that moment, she defied rotten law. I mean, the Boston Tea Party would be another example. Since we're prosecuted and persecuted for sexual acts, it then becomes logical in my reasoning to say that public sex is the only direct confrontation that we have with an oppressor who hates us for our sexuality. Otherwise, it's closet heterosexuality, closet homosexuality.
But you could say that a lot of the sexuality that you're talking about is happening in gay bars and not on the streets where a lot of people are watching. And an argument could be made that in those cases, sometimes homosexuals are oppressing other homosexuals through very sadomasochistic sexuality.
I'm very opposed to sadomasochism, you see, and when certain acts are hidden, the same acts that were defiant at one time and that now are duplicated in hidden places, to me those are reactionary. They are no longer radical, you see. The radical ones is not in being seen, because most public sex is unseen to anybody except two factions, homosexuals and the police. But you see, you do confront. There is a psychic assault. Now, one of the most awful myths, and you know, we homosexual males inherit myths very much like women have inherited certain myths, and women are having to undo them, like the myth of a woman welcoming rape. I mean, for a long time that was ingrained. We homosexual men have inherited a lot of heterosexual myths, and one of the main ones, you see, is that we do sex in public in order to get caught, because we're courting danger. Now, see, that's a very dangerous thing, because if you follow that, and a lot of homosexuals say, yes, that's the excitement. Now, if you follow that, why would you want to get caught? Because you feel guilty. Why do you feel guilty? Because you want to get punished. So, you see, that becomes one of those mythologies that we have to undo. I say, it's not that we want to get caught. It's that they have repressed us to such an extent that, like true radicals, true revolutionaries, we want to, pardon the pun, but I mean it, we want to shoot in public.
Well, how many people who are into that do you think feel that there's something political behind it, or that there's some worldview that explains why they're doing it, as opposed to just wanting to have lots of sex?
Terry, that really doesn't matter as far as I'm concerned, because any kind of revolution, whether it be political, political as far as changing a government, political as far as changing of consciousness, every kind of revolution has acts that are not defined by the action until they are translated into a logical pattern. I mean, the intellectual defines the act of revolution. The anger is something that bursts in ways that people don't understand. I'm sure, again, that noble black woman didn't think, "I'm starting the civil rights movement." Her feet hurt. You know, she just didn't want to walk to the back of the bus. The woman who went and drank out of the whites only water faucet, she didn't start that. So it's not important, you see. No, I don't think that the men that are out cruising the trucks or the piers or anything are aware at that moment. But it is up to those of us who go on to see it, to define it and to bring an awareness. So that what I call the reactionary faction of the homosexual movement, who looks down on and even cooperates in raids on these places, will understand. And so that will ultimately change.
When the film Cruising came out, a lot of men in the gay community disavowed the film, not only because they thought it was a hateful film, but because they thought it exaggerated everything that happened in that aspect of the gay community, and that sadomasochistic sex was equated with real pain and with the dealing of actually murderous blows. Where were you in the middle of, during all of that?
Okay, I wrote a piece for the Village Voice, which created a furor, because I upheld Friedkin's... I have admired Friedkin. I think he's a major director. I upheld Friedkin's right to make this movie. And my own books, all the way from City of Night to Rush's to The Sexual Outlaw, had faced censorship and pre-censorship. Now, I don't think that you can become liberated by becoming the oppressor, and I see a lot of this happening. Friedkin had every right in the world to make that movie. We had every right in the world then to protest after it was made. We did not have any right to stop it. What I wrote was my upholding of being opposed to censorship, see? And in fact, I did have something more direct to do with that movie, because when Friedkin was embattled and nobody was being shown this film, he called me up. I do not know him, but apparently he knew I was in town and asked me to see this movie before it was released in New York to the press. And over the weekend, I was able to effect two very important changes, which I thought would dissipate some of the potential danger. The irony is that when this became known, I was very criticized by homosexual groups who said that I had no right to alter the danger that this film could have brought, because they could have then dealt with it. And what I had done by making these suggestions was to diffuse the very things that could have been dangerous in this film within the reality of one weekend intervening. See, I wrote the foreword that opens the movie that says that this is a small segment, with the exception of the last line, which he added. I wrote that foreword.
What was that last line?
The last line, I forget. I had wanted something to say that there was no indictment indicated here, but I forgot what the movie has now, but it's what it carries. And I also was responsible for deleting the opening shot. Now, I was amazed that Friedkin is not anti-homosexual. Friedkin is a typical Hollywood director who didn't know what the hell he was doing. He is fascinated by male flesh. And I'm going to say something very shocking. As shoddy as the movie is, and as demoralizing as it is, and as immoral as Friedkin, with all due respect to him as a filmmaker, as immoral as Friedkin was to do that movie without understanding this very deep wound in the homosexual psyche, there is more radical content in that movie to the heterosexual world than there is in that current very odious movie, which is a favorite among both homosexuals and heterosexuals, called La Cage aux Folles, Birds of a Feather. And I believe that. Because your consciousness is raised visually, and the people who will for the first time, and I'm not vaunting the macho thing, because I think the transvestite is a heroine of our world, and I know that women view it differently, but I have a different view of that. But for the first time, they see an image that alters their conception of what homosexuals are. You don't retain the nuances of what he's saying. The visual image is very, very powerful. Whereas La Cage aux Folles presents these two unrealistic, cute little fairies, and everybody goes out of the theater feeling righteous and purged and saying, I'm very, very tolerant. I mean, those poor little fairies, how could anybody do anything to them? But to me, you see, the more radical one, I mean, to thrust an image that's going to stamp in their minds and say, don't screw with us, is different from one that says, look how cute and helpless we are. Why don't you just leave us alone as long as we marry and have this apartment and have a black butler and, you know, all this thing. So that, to me, is a hateful movie.
D- Do you think that the macho image amongst some gay men now is a reaction at all to the limp-wristed stereotype?
Yes, Terry, but to a great extent. But I don't welcome it, you see. I don't welcome it because along with it is coming, we are now adopting the worst of the heterosexual in great areas. We're adopting the worst of the heterosexual macho. And coupled with some negative aspects in the homosexual psyche, which have been created by the heterosexual world, what emerges is not a very liberating posture, you see. And so you have some of the, I mean, like, I vaunt abundant sexuality. I don't think that we homosexual men should ever apologize for being able to have sex with 20 men in one day. There's nothing wrong with that. But you should also be able to feel for one person. Now, this is what is often missed in my writing. I'm calling for a spectrum, see? And there's a lot of words that are used that make semantic judgments. Promiscuity is one. So you say promiscuity and you make a judgment. But if you say profligacy, sexual abundance, that's something else, see? You use the word infidelity and you're already on trial. But if you say a broad spectrum of activity, then that means you can be in love with one person, but you can have sex with 10 others. And I mean, I can have both. I'm having both.
Since you've said that promiscuity is a revolutionary act, do you think that the gay man who isn't promiscuous, who has a monogamous or fairly monogamous relationship, is either like less gay or less righteous?
No, because I don't impose my views on anybody. You see, what is happening is that, for example, my attitudes are the ones that get attacked by the people who insist that they're going to get married and they're going to be just real nice fairies, and at the next fundraiser somebody's going to pat them on the back and say, you're nice fairies because you don't do X, Y, and Z, and you wear a tie and you're just like us, but you help us get those other uglies out there because they're giving you a bad name, see? They're the ones that are after me. I'm not after them. I'm perfectly happy to leave them lead their good lives. I mean, that's fine with me. But when they cooperate in drives into streets and areas that will then arrest me, and I've been busted twice, so I know what I'm talking about. I've been busted for prostitution twice. And when they cooperate, then I'm being victimized. So you see, I'm the one that it has the burden of saying, lay off me. I'm not doing anything to you. You're the one that's doing it to me.
It's interesting. As far as I can tell, attitudes towards sex are somewhat different in the lesbian community than in the gay men's community. Or what I should say is, because I don't want to generalize too much about either group, that I don't know that there is an equivalent for the kind of promiscuity that you're talking about particularly within the politicized gay women's mm-hmm. community. Usually if there's like a lesbian magazine or newspaper, it's going to be a pretty politically oriented one, and not, I don't know of a gay women's magazine, or certainly not a lesbian feminist magazine, that is the equivalent of something like Blue Boy with naked spreads on it, or any bars that are the equivalent of the kinds of bars that you write about, the S&M bars along the piers. Mm-hmm. And I don't hear the emphasis on either promiscuity or on just the importance of sex, lots of sex, mm-hmm. amongst gay women. It's a question of preference, but I don't hear that same emphasis on the sex act.
Well, I don't see why.
I'm not saying that gay women don't enjoy sex.
No, but I would point out that I don't see why there should be. This is okay. See, again, it's that spectrum of difference. You know, I'm all for a good relationship between homosexual men and lesbians and heterosexual women and all this and that. But we have different problems. See, this is where we run, where we get into a real tizzy and a real tangle. This is where we wrangle. We do have deep, profound problems. Remember that you know, I mean, I know this sounds, you know, like really ragingly radical, but I think that women, you know, radical women, reach a point where they feel that and have to feel and move away from and move into that the male, the heterosexual male, is the natural enemy of the female. I think that the black, in order to become revolutionized and then move, has to face that the white man is his natural enemy. And that the homosexual male has to realize that the heterosexual male, and to an extent, the heterosexual woman, less extent, but still to an extent, is a natural enemy. Now, that doesn't mean everyone, but that as a society, as a group, you see, we can begin with this concept. We have got to educate. Now, a lot of what is happening is that you have the homosexual trying to please a heterosexual. We have not done anything to them. They should be apologizing to us, man. I mean, when we get little crumbs like Masters and Johnson saying, well, we're all right because we're so similar and everything like this, I really rage, and I've written reviews about this, and Kinsey saying the same thing. What they do really is just extend the demarcation line to include what is relatively acceptable, and then exclude more of what is different. See, that's no liberation. That's absorption. That's like the blacks when they were straightening their hair, bleaching their face. See, and when we can have abundant sexuality, and I'm talking as a homosexual male, I wouldn't presume to talk about, you know, other than what I know. When we start abandoning or saying we don't have the leather scene and we don't have so-called promiscuity, I would say, let's investigate it. Now, is abundant sex an embellishment to experience? I say yes. Now, does it blot out the possibility for love? I say emphatically no, and I can use my own example. There's somebody I love very much, totally open. And I mean, it's lasted because we can have sex with whoever we want under any conditions, but there's that knowledge that the person is first. Now, about S&M, I have gotten into a lot of trouble because of my criticism of S&M. You see, to me, sadomasochism is anti-sexual. And the uniform of black leather, to me, metaphorically, is the uniform of the death, the mourning of sex. You see, it's the only uniform that we have, that we males have, that is created by us. I mean, the macho costume uniform is great, you know, so what? I mean, you know, we're imitating the cowboy on the range, the muscular look. I mean, I weight lift, I want to be muscular, I want to look a certain way, it's attractive. You like that image, a sailor, you know, okay, fine thing. But the black leather, you see, is one of mourning. And increasingly in the sadomasochistic orgy rooms, you don't have sex. It's a very puritanistic thing in which the body, I mean, for so long the exposed body was not allowed. Now we allow the exposed body. The sadomasochistic faction, by the large, clothes the body and punishes for the sexual desire. Increasingly, sadomasochistic acts have nothing to do with sexuality. Now, again, what I would emphasize, and I've said this before, in a homosexual sadomasochistic relationship, there is one sadist, and that is the invisible heterosexual, which has made us feel that we need still punishment for sex. And we can't allow ourselves not to look at our own troubled frontier.
If homosexuals didn't need to be underground at all, if there was a complete sense of normalcy about all kinds of sexual behavior, if everything was accepted, do you think that homosexual patterns would change at all?
I think that the main one that I would like to see change would be the need for rituals in which we imitate our heterosexual oppressor, whether it be by insisting on getting married and all that, if one wants to, but also in punishing each other and playing playing queer to somebody playing heterosexual. See, I think that is very counter-revolutionary.
One of the things that struck me about, against certain aspects of gay male life, and I keep saying certain aspects just because I think it's really unfair to generalize about any community, so I, you know,
sure.
Particularly here, because there's just so many different kinds of people and different ways of being gay. But there's, among some groups, just a real strong emphasis on youth, that it's important to be young, it's important to be pretty, and if you're lucky, you get older. And I think as you get older, you appreciate less and less that that emphasis on youth, because it's something that's fleeting.
Terry, that's another of those problems we have to deal with, but also we have to deal with them realistically. You see, I resent a certain kind of puritanism that is happening in the homosexual world. I am very aware of my body, and I work out and do all this, and some people would criticize me because of the emphasis on the physicality of it. Look, racism, of course. Sexism is an ageism. All these are problems that are with us and that we have to deal with. Now, throughout all of our societies, youth and beauty are at a premium. Hoping is not going to change this. I mean, I find that there's a lot of hoping that is masquerading for fact. Look, the attractive person is bound to have more sex than the unattractive person. You are not going to change that. You're not going to change that. If we can bring less cruelty to it, if we can bring less cruelty to it and make more accessibility, you know, in social context to other milieus, then we're ahead. But we are never going to, you see, I get criticized because I'm always writing about attractive men and all this and that. It happens that in the homosexual world, yes, indeed, the attractive man is going to get more sex than the unattractive man. But I also decry very much a new generation that is coming around where, for example, in some Los Angeles orgy rooms, there are signs that say, no one over 35, no fats, no femmes, no ethnics. You see, that generation, every time somebody walks through one of those signs, he is establishing his own death at the age of 35. And I'm very worried about this new generation, see. I feel a great responsibility toward young people. And they have to carry a lot of responsibility for the world that's going to come.
You know, for women, there was always a stereotype that if you were really beautiful, you were probably really dumb. And
of course, that's not true.
Well, but like, look at movies. A lot of like the really
that's one of the things.
Well,
you had to be
beautiful to be in a movie in the first place. But there's the whole, you know, gorgeous dumb blonde type stereotype.
Right.
And I wonder if you've come across any equivalents in men where if you're, you know, really muscular or really attractive, then you're probably not really smart.
I flatter myself on my honesty, and I never criticize anything when I can't criticize myself. And I will tell you, just between you and me, and whoever is listening, that I still do some things very reactionary. I mean, when I'm playing an anonymous person, I talk differently, I act differently, and I have a very elegant deportment. And if I bring somebody over, more times than not, I'll tell them that it's somebody else's apartment because I am so afraid that somebody will think, oh, he's not so macho because look at this apartment. But let me tell you a recent incident that happened to me that really sobered me up. I came home with somebody and I was playing my macho muscular role and talking jive and doing the whole number. We walk into this very elegant apartment. I say, I'm just staying here with a friend of mine, man. He's, you know, he's gone. He's not here for a while. And we go about our business and then everything's fine. And he comes by, puts on the light in the front room, looks around at this very elegant apartment. He says, wow, you really live with a screaming fag. Now, that was consciousness raising. That was consciousness raising because it showed me what silly posturing I was involved in. See, so I try at the same time that I still do it, I do it less and less. See, and now I can actually walk into my apartment, having played my role, and say, "This is my apartment," and even tell people I'm a writer. Of course, now increasingly I get recognized, so that's something else. But those things, you see, they're so deep in us. And that's why I say, you know, like when I criticize sadomasochism, I'm not criticizing it from a moralistic point of view, Terry. I've been in it. I've worn the uniform, and I've played the roles. I am still very, very attracted to it. But again, as I said before, we have to talk about it, you see. And it's possible that people of my generation, people younger, will never be free of that oppression. But if we talk about it, I was giving a talk in New York just the other day, and a young kid said, your books are so depressing. And he said, you know, what's the way out? I mean, this is how you view it, and this is the world that we see. And I found myself answering, okay, if my books depress you, and I've presented this as an accurate world, which I hope I have, then maybe you won't have to go through the very same things that I do. Maybe you can see the traps if they are traps, where they are traps, then you won't have to experience the same things I did. And if you think of it as a generational thing, the next generation will inherit less things. But if they inherit orgy rooms that imitate the places where we used to have to go, the dirty toilets and all that, then we've left them a horrible legacy. It's like a ritual mass, which is what Rush's is really about. It's in a sadomasochistic orgy room, but it's structured as a mass, and it ends up, you know, in an orgy room in which there is a symbolic and then literal crucifixion that occurs.
What do you think the priorities of the gay movement should be?
The what?
The priorities of the gay movement. What do you think they should be?
Well, that's a hard question. You know, some people would say civil rights and everything. I, myself, as an artist, would say not losing our specialness first.
Let's talk about your writing a little bit.
Good.
Do you feel that being a homosexual and that writing about homosexuality has affected the way you've been reviewed by critics?
I have, Terry. I'm very lucky in that I'm one of the few writers, in fact, perhaps very modestly, I may be the only overtly identified homosexual writer that has actually broken through into the so-called mainstream of literature. I mean, I've got an article. I mean, People magazine has covered me, you know, stuff like that. This is what I mean. But we have to go through incredible difficulties. Now, The Sexual Outlaw, for example, the bookstores wouldn't carry it. CBS and NBC rejected advertisements for it, saying it was worse than dirty. Rush's had a difficult time getting into some of the bookstores. The Sexual Outlaw had a trial going on in England. We're not treated seriously, see, but part of it, unfortunately, is becoming our fault. First of all, the literary establishment will not allow us. You see, some of the six top homosexual writers could write circles around at least the six top heterosexual writers now. But you won't hear this acknowledgement. The newspapers will always throw us to the back pages. But what is happening now with the homosexual magazines is that in a happy tizzy, they're telling us that we have to write. And listen, writers like me get letters saying you're not politically correct. You're giving the old stereotypes and everything like that. Writers like me are being called upon to be false, to be fake, and to tell untruths. And what's happening to our literature? Under that climate, an acerbic Gore Vidal could not thrive. I mean, the glittery drag of Truman Capote would not be acceptable. The toughness of Last Exit to Brooklyn would not be possible. Where would William Burroughs be? Genet, Proust. You see, we're being forced to be ninnies. So we have all these talented writers writing silly stuff about watching men's nipples on Fire Island. But, I mean, where is the great transvestite novel? Where is the good novel coming out of the young man who moves into the ghetto and suddenly is surrounded by this sexuality so that his whole life is molded? Where is the novel coming from an older man who is looking at a world that is so different from the one he saw? You see, unfortunately, what is published influences what is written more than what is written influences what is published. And as long as these ninny publications are telling us that we've got to be politically correct, we're going to feed them untruths. And that's where our writing is now. And we're going to lose more than we're going to gain.
Do you feel like you've been treated fairly in book reviews?
No, of course not. First of all, I'm a much better writer than I've been given credit for because my subjects are so overwhelmingly sexual that the structure, for example, Rush's is in a sadomasochistic leather and Western bar, but the structure of it is of a mass. I actually read the Catholic Mass every day before I started the book so that the structure would permeate. There are 15 chapters corresponding to the 15 stations of the cross. The pornographic images on the wall are really transmogrifications of the stations of the cross. The incense every time that poppers are popped in the book, that corresponds to incense in a church. The bar becomes shaped like a chapel, and the whole thing works on a symbolic, although realistic level. This is a real cowboy, western, macho bar and orgy room. But the structure of my book, even The Sexual Outlaw, is written almost like a film script because I wanted that immediate documentary quality. See, I've done a lot of experimenting with literature. My books, damn it, are literature. Yet the subject, relentlessly, that's what people talk, and they don't see past it. The Vampires was a wonderful comic strip book that I wrote with a lot of exaggerated characters. And I'm very careful, you see. Yet there's this image that I'm some kind of accidental writer that writes about hustlers and promiscuity. I actually teach a writing course at UCLA, which is one of the most successful ones in the country, I'm glad to say. Two novels have already been published from it. Another novel will come out, which you'll be hearing about very shortly. Grand novel, and a play in Los Angeles being produced out of this course.
John, we're out of time. It's really been interesting to have you here.
It's
I wish we
been
could talk
good
some more.
To talk to you.
I hope if you come back to Philadelphia, you'll let us know.
I'll sure do it, and thank you for the good questions.
Thanks, and thanks for being here. Right. I've been talking with novelist John Retchie, and let me just run through what some of his novels are. Now, the most recent one is called Rushes, and it's published by the Grove Press, which is his principal publisher. He's also written The Vampires, which he just mentioned, The Sexual Outlaw, which is a documentary. It's part fiction, part nonfiction. His first novel, City of Night, was published in 1963. Tomorrow afternoon, he'll be at Giovanni's Room in Philadelphia at 345 South 12th Street for an autograph party. That will be held between 3:30 and 5:30. So again, that's at Giovanni's Room tomorrow afternoon at 345 South 12th Street. That's 12th and Pine. 3:30 to 5:30. Then there'll be a reading at the Gay Coffee House, and that's at 326 Cater Street, which is near 4th and South. Again, that's 326 Cater Street near 4th and South. And the reading will be between 7:30 and 9:30. There'll be donations at the door for the benefit of the new Gay Community Center. So that's all tomorrow. John Retchie, enjoy your stay in Philadelphia, and thanks for being
Perry,
here.
Thank you for your very good questions. That was a very good interview, if I may compliment you.
Thanks.